key idea in this book is that failure in financial markets is like a vortex in a sink, a pernicious, self-reinforcing downward cycle that gains momentum and force the longer it runs and the greater the velocity. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Today's guests are Robert Bruner and Sean Carr. Bob Bruner is Dean and Distinguished Professor of Business Administration at the Darden Graduate School of Business Administration here at the University of Virginia. He teaches mergers and acquisitions, among other courses. Bob Bruner earned his undergraduate degree at Yale and both the master's and the doctorate in business administration at Harvard. Sean Carr, who will speak second, is the Director of Corporate Innovation Programs for the Batten Institute at the Darden Graduate School of Business Administration. Sean Carr was educated at Northwestern University for his undergraduate degree, then took a degree from the Columbia School of Journalism and received his master's in business administration here at the University of Virginia. Their new book, The Panic of 1907, Lessons Learned from the Market's Perfect Storm, was published just several weeks ago, very timely, and already it has received critical acclaim for its detailed walk through the causes of the 1907 panic and for the insights it provides that some believe can be applied to the credit markets in 2007. Please welcome Bob Bruner and Sean Carr.
George, thank you very much for that kind introduction. It's a pleasure for both of us to be here. This project has its roots in a previous book on which Sean and I collaborated, a book entitled Deals from Hell, about mergers and acquisitions that fail. And in this project, we took the theme of failure, of breakdown, up to the level of the macro economy. So we are painting on a much larger canvas. As business professionals and as investors, we should pay attention to events such as these. And the stories, the lessons from them, can actually help us think about events as they're unfolding in the current environment. The key idea in this book is that failure in financial markets is like a vortex in a sink, a pernicious, self-reinforcing downward cycle that gains momentum and force the longer it runs and the greater the velocity. Failure exerts its own gravitational pull. This book is about the how and why of such failure and the downward cycle. Needless to say, this is an urgent subject. We have events unfolding around us yet today to which this history speaks. And it's clear that billions, indeed trillions of dollars are invested and outstanding in securities on the belief of confidence in the financial system. And in respect for investors. An immense amount of research suggests that investors and depositors get about what they deserve. So, as Mark Twain said, be good and you will be lonely. You could also say be very, very bad and you'll be lonely. Unfortunately, we are reminded about lonely moments such as these today. I'll give my co-author an opportunity to sketch for you the story.
And thank you all. Thank you, George. So I'm here to tell you a story, the story of a panic, the story of the panic of 1907, and to do it very quickly. So here we go. Okay, the story of the panic in just a few easy steps. It begins, actually, in 1906 with the San Francisco earthquake, April 1906. It is a real economic shock, which in turn triggers a huge demand on capital in the U.S. and throughout the world. Now, this is all occurring at a time when the U.S. economy is growing exponentially. Between 1870 and 1900, national income in the United States tripled. GDP growth in 1907 was 7.3%, a rip-roaring rate. Now, following the earthquake, as this liquidity was demanded to reconstruct San Francisco, central banks in England, Germany, France were raising their benchmark interest rates to stanch the flow of gold to the U.S. Remember, at this time, London is the financial capital of the world, and the United States is an emerging economy. The United States was the China of its day. Well, by the winter of 1906 and 1907, we were in a state of credit anorexia, a credit crunch, if you will. As capital was drying up and investors became spooked, stock prices began to fall. 7.7% that fall in winter. By March 1907, they fell 9.8% in 1 month alone. Bankruptcy claims were up 38% in April over the year previously. And amid this tumult, President Theodore Roosevelt gave his predatory man of wealth speech in Indianapolis on Memorial Day. In June, the Bank of England takes the next step. It prohibits the issuance of U.S. finance bills. Now, these are loans that would allow the import of gold to the U.S. They prohibit that. Well, U.S. gold flowed back to London as the outstanding finance bills matured. U.S. gold reserves contracted by 10% between May and August. On June 28th, the city of New York failed to place a $30 million bond. U.S. Steel reports a 25% decline in its book of business. Recession is in full swing, and again, the stock market drops 8% between June and September. And again, President Theodore Roosevelt gives another speech in which he blasts the malefactors of great wealth, in effect pointing his finger at people like J.P. Morgan, who we'll hear about in a moment. This brings us to October, October 1907, 100 years ago, almost to the day. Augustus Hines, a swashbuckling maverick who had made millions in the copper fields of Montana, had come to New York to become a banker. Well, Augustus Hines and his partners had attempted to squeeze the stock of a certain copper company, United Copper, on Tuesday, October 15th. His stock manipulation fails, and there's an immediate fallout. Two brokerage firms go down with it. That's Wednesday, October 16th. Then, that wouldn't mean much, but the banks were in trouble. Why? Rumors are swirling. Remember, this is New York City 100 years ago. The financial district is a fairly intimate place. Panicked depositors are running to financial institutions because they have heard that Hines's bank was in trouble. Hines's bank was the Mercantile National Bank, and that required rescuing by the New York Clearinghouse, which is an association of banks, on October 17th and 19th. Also, the Bank of North America and New Amsterdam National Banks were also in trouble because of alleged connections with this nefarious figure, Augustus Hines. But that's not it. There's something called the trust company. The trust companies, not to be confused with the trust like Standard Oil, but the trust companies were a new form of a financial intermediary. They had operated to handle trusts and estates, but they were increasingly taking on a banking role. They had large amounts of money pouring into them. They were unregulated. Well, the National Bank of Commerce refused to clear the checks for the Knickerbocker Trust Company because of rumors of its affiliation with Augustus Hines on October 22nd. There's a run on the Knickerbocker Trust. The Knickerbocker Trust suspends. That's when we learn of J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan, on that day, October 21st actually, was here in Virginia, in Richmond, at the Triennial Episcopal Convention. He was 70 years old, semi-retired, had handed over the operations of his firm to his son. He was suffering from a terrible cold, and he refused to come to New York. But his associates begged and pleaded that he do so. He refused to come because he thought by his presence he would make things look worse. But things were worse. And upon the pressure from his partners, he came to New York, looked at the books of the Trust Company of America, the Knickerbocker Trust, and in a famous moment at the height of the crisis, he said on October 23rd, "This is the place to stop the trouble then." And that was the beginning of the end. Immediately, he demands, remember, a private banker demands the presence of the Treasury Secretary to come from Washington to New York City. On October 23rd to 24th, he engineers the rescue of the Trust Company America, one of the troubled trusts. October 24th to 25th, he rescues the New York Stock Exchange, which was about to close. The head of the exchange came to him in a moment of panic and frustration and said, "Mr. Morgan, we must close the exchange." And he said, "You will do no such thing. It will not close a minute before 3 o'clock. On October 28th and 29th, again, the city of New York is in trouble. They can't float their bonds. They're about to go into bankruptcy. J.P. Morgan saves the day. November 2nd to the 4th, the rescue of another brokerage firm with the acquisition by U.S. Steel of another firm that was about to go under. And November 2nd to 3rd, Morgan forces the trust companies to come to his house, the presidents of all the trust companies in his house, puts them in his library, takes the key, puts it in his pocket, and tells them, do not leave here until you come up with a rescue plan to save the other trust companies. And that they did at 5:30 a.m. the next day. By November 5th, the crisis, in effect, is over. The Dow Jones, by that time, had fallen 37% from its all-time high that year. 25 banks and 17 trust companies had failed. This crisis in the United States was associated with financial crises in Germany, the Netherlands, Italy, Denmark, France, even Japan. Following this was a very sharp and severe recession beginning until June 1908. 8% unemployment, commodity prices down 21%. This was the sharpest recession up to 1907, and full recovery took another 2 years. Now, to reflect on this, I'd like to turn back to Bob.
There are many metaphors you could use to describe what Sean has just sketched. One is a series of falling dominoes. We prefer a metaphor that's actually in some current vogue, and it's reflected on the cover of the book, The Perfect Storm. It's truly a convergence of many forces that create a maelstrom of unexpected force. What is it that comes together? We identify seven factors, and it's important that you keep these factors in mind because we'll argue that you can't really call it a crisis unless you have truly a coming together of all seven. The first factor is rapid growth, a period that precedes the crisis of very buoyant expansion. John Maynard Keynes said, we should be less surprised by the crises and the busts than by the booms that precede them. There is something in markets that leads to unexpected, perhaps irrational expansion. We point to a second factor. Complexity. Complexity is a delicious topic that we could discuss in great detail during the question period, but suffice it to say that in a complex system, you really don't have a sense of what's going on. Was the economy in the United States in 1907 complex? Yes, in a word, is especially complex relative to the communication systems that prevailed at the day. The telephone was just coming into vogue. It was rather like a text messaging, and was known and available and used by decision makers only in rather special circles. Complexity could be attributable to the size and scope of an economy. It could be due to technology. It could be due to financial innovation in the design of institutions and securities. But the second factor illustrates the fundamental point of Warren Buffett's famous quotation. He said, "You don't know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out." You don't know. You don't know. It's the issue of information asymmetry. The third attribute is inflexibility. Inflexibility. It's the absence of sufficient safety buffers or cushion against shocks. Inflexibility could be illustrated by the absence of adequate reserves for financial institutions, the insufficiency of cash on hand for financial institutions, the lack of time to remedy problems, or surely the unalterable commitment to a path of action given the rapid development of events may be rendered infeasible. In an inflexible system, trouble can spread. Trouble can spread rapidly. We characterize the structure of institutions and markets as a financial system for a good reason, like a home heating system or like the body is a system. You perturb one part of the system, and that radiates out through the rest of the system. Well, in an inflexible system, trouble travels. The fourth factor in financial crises is what we call cognitive bias. This is a term borrowed from the field of psychology. Cognitive bias could be over-optimism, over-pessimism, frenzy to get deals done, failure to ignore sunk costs. It could be panic on the part of depositors who stand in long lines on the streets. It could be cash hoarding, literally taking your money out of a bank and shoving it under a mattress or under the hearthstone or into a hole in the backyard. These cognitive biases are phenomena that we are understanding better and better. The recent Nobel Prize of a few years ago to Daniel Kahneman and others was a recognition of the role of cognitive bias or over-optimism in the crises that we face in economics. Fifth, we should reserve a role for leaders in financial crises, what they do or maybe what they shouldn't have done. We call this the dimension adverse leadership. It's the role of leaders in doing things that advertently or inadvertently elevate the risk inherent in a financial system. What was going on here? We see leadership in the form of Theodore Roosevelt, who was embarked on a new political program to bring greater regulation to the wild and open business economy of the day, truly economic leadership in the form of Augustus Hines, a business leader, a president of a bank who arguably drew on resources of the bank and other institutions in ways that elevated the risk to those institutions. If you talk to the man or woman on the street in the midst of a crisis, he or she will say, it's due to the CEO, it's due to the leader, it's all their fault. Well, what our analysis shows is they may have a role in the scenario. Let's acknowledge that they're part of the problem. All the foregoing factors themselves don't dictate a crisis. There has to be a spark. And the spark in this crisis was a real shock. It was the San Francisco earthquake of April 1906. But it was also, arguably, the failed speculation in early October 1907. Each crisis has a trigger. So you see the story. There's a trigger in this taut system following a period of very buoyant growth and overexpansion. The trouble breaks out. It spreads. The seventh and final factor is the adequacy or inadequacy of response on the scene. Economists recognize the problem of the prisoner's dilemma. It's the failure of parties to act in concert in ways that respond to a crisis, that actually elevate the welfare of all the players on the scene. This is a very widely used model to explain problems such as environmental degradation or the decline of inner cities. But in this case, the prisoner's dilemma helps us understand why, when crises really spin out of control, they do so badly, or they help us understand why crises are stemmed. Our book shows that J.P. Morgan led a process of building collective action to rescue banks, rescue the stock exchange, rescue New York City, arguably rescue the entire financial system, and he resolved the problem of inadequate collective action. All these seven factors constitute for us the system of failure, the perfect storm, the convergence that drives financial crisis. Rapid growth, complexity, inflexibility, cognitive biases, risky behavior of leaders. Then a shock occurs, followed by poor response, poor results, more confusion, propagation of the crisis. And so we have the pernicious downward cycle of the crisis. So what? What do we take away from this today? First, it is that there is no silver bullet, no single explanation that adequately describes the occurrence and cause of crises. Second, it is that failures are systems. They arise from a coming together of many factors, and that if we want to fight crises, what we must do is fight the convergence of these factors. Shock travels through a system and is amplified, often triggering more shock. We need to fight the amplification process, the process by which contagion occurs. Our story says, in addition, that to anticipate failure, We should watch for the convergence. We should be storm spotters. We should be alert as depositors and investors. We should be alert to the coming together of these factors. And finally, to avoid failure, we should attack the self-reinforcing nature of crises. This may require extraordinary rescue efforts. It may require bringing together adversaries in ways that compel them to pull together, to pool resources. It may require the delegation of authority, decision-making authority, down to the scene of the crisis rather than up at the lofty heights, wherever they may be. In conclusion, the big idea of our book is that failure is a self-reinforcing, pernicious cycle. We've seen this in microcosm, in corporate finance, writing about deals from hell, companies that have gone bad. The Darden School, we teach cases about failure as a way of illustrating to our students what not to do and what to do better next time. So we can take such stories up to the level of the macroeconomy to understand what chairmen of the board of the Federal Reserve, what presidents of the United States, what CEOs of major financial institutions should do in days like today. I'd also conclude with the point that academic studies of an episode like this, our reliance on systems thinking, is of a piece with a larger trend in academia to look at the systemic nature of phenomena in business. Such research is going on at places like the Santa Fe Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the Max Planck Institute in Germany, and other places where scholars are bringing together a systems engineering-based framework to understand failure and the breakdown of social systems. I hope you've enjoyed this brief sketch and the work that Sean and I have done, and we look forward to your questions and comments. Thank you very much.
I'd like to prime the pump, if I may, with a question. You have told us very generally how J.P. Morgan stepped in to organize a rescue. I wonder if you could walk us through with some specificity what the rescue, how it was structured, exactly what was done to step in the middle and end of October. And then if you could talk a little bit about the public reaction. Were they greeted as saviors of the economy? Were rose petals strewn in their paths, or were people suspicious of their motives and what they did?
Why don't you take the first?
Thanks, Bob. thanks for listening to our talk, and thanks for bearing with a very rapid and quick run through of the events of 1907. But thanks, George, for asking maybe for a little bit of specificity around what J.P. Morgan actually did. So I mentioned that on October 21st, he had arrived back in New York. The first thing he did was get off his private train from Richmond, went directly to his house at 36th Street and Madison Avenue in New York City, which you could still visit today, and at which we had done significant research to pull from the archives, to read through telegrams and transcripts and documents from J.P. Morgan himself and his associates. So we know much about what had gone on. Interestingly, we don't know much about what J.P. Morgan himself said, since he tended not to write much down. But he was surrounded by lots of thoughtful people who wrote down all the things he did and where he went and who he talked to. When he got back to his house on that day, he asked for the presence of the head of U.S. Steel, the head of other major corporations in New York City, the heads of the major banks, First National Bank, National City Bank, to come and see him so he could get an assessment. In much the same way that today we know that the Federal Reserve chairman, in this case Ben Bernanke, has the authority to get information about the state of affairs in the financial system. Well, remember, in 1907, there was no central bank. The crisis of 1907 was the last major financial crisis before the establishment of the Federal Reserve System. So J.P. Morgan was uniquely qualified to get information and to demand it in front of him that day. So he asked for the information, called for smart people to get around him, looked to where the trouble was. In this case, we were looking at the Knickerbocker Trust Company and then the Trust Company of America, and demanded to see their books. He at first, after looking through the books and having two of his partners look through them in detail overnight, by the 22nd had reached a conclusion that he would not intervene with the Knickerbocker Trust Company. He said that even though a old school friend of his had established that bank, there weren't sufficient assets to support lending it further money. With the Trust Company of America, however, he made a judgment call that there were sufficient assets to continue to make loans, and he asked the heads of the two largest banks in the city and in the United States at the time, they would put together a pool of $3 million and literally send over bags of cash to the Trust Company of America, which had lines of people waiting to take their money out. People were running for the exits. They were nervous that they wouldn't get, in this case, gold and silver, because bear in mind we're on the gold standard at this point. J.P. Morgan, with the help of the bankers, pulled the money, the cash together, had it brought down to the Trust Company of America to help stanch the flow. Now, that was just the beginning and just the first step, but that scene was effectively repeated on a number of occasions.
So George's other question was, how was this received? And the answer is, Morgan was applauded greatly in the weeks following the conclusion of the panic, and then in early 1908, a reaction set in, and this is a reaction among progressive politicians mainly, who began to question, why had Morgan waited so long to get involved in the crisis, and second, had he engineered this crisis for his own profit? There's nothing we found in the archives to suggest support for great self-interest. Surely he and his firm and the other banks charged interest on the loans they made in the rescue loans to all of the parties. This is business after all. They were going to profit from it in an ordinary way. But there was a charge that Morgan was actually trying to engineer the collapse of the new trust companies, which had arisen. Much like the hedge funds today, they were unruly new players in the capital markets in 1907. And the charge was Morgan was trying to engineer a reaction against them. And congressional hearings, academic studies since then have tended to discount. In fact, found no clear evidence in favor of the charge that he was trying to use the panic for strategic purposes. But the famous hearings in Congress that ultimately resulted in the founding of the U.S. Federal Reserve Systems, some of them very tense cross-examinations of J.P. Morgan, actually found no evidence in favor of a so-called money trust that was attempting to manipulate the markets and profit from the panic.
I'd also like to share with you, so to put that also in a little bit of context, you know, you'd asked, well, was were flowers being strewn at his feet because of all of his efforts? And accompanying Morgan through most of these days of the crisis in the weeks of October and November 1907, he was accompanied by a man named Herbert Satterley. Herbert Satterley was his son-in-law, and he must have taken copious notes because he wrote a book about all of this and most of J.P. Morgan's life. And he wrote a very detailed account of J.P. Morgan on the fourth day of the crisis, which I'd like to read with you, if I may. These are Satterley's words. "Anyone who saw Mr. Morgan going from the clearinghouse back to his office that day will never forget the picture. With his coat unbuttoned and flying open, a piece of white paper clutched tightly in his right hand, he walked fast down Nassau Street. His flat-top black derby, his hat, was set firmly down on his head. Between his teeth, he held a cigar holder in which was one of his long cigars, half-smoked. His eyes were fixed straight ahead. He swung his arms as he walked and took no notice of anyone. He did not seem to see the throngs in the street. So intent was his mind on the thing that he was doing. Everyone knew him, and people made way for him, except some who were equally intent on their own affairs, and these he brushed aside. The thing that made his progress different from that of all the other people on the street was that he did not dodge or walk in and out or halt or slacken his pace. He simply barged along as if he had been the only man going down Nassau Street Hill past the sub-treasury. He was the embodiment of power and purpose. Not more than 2 minutes after he disappeared into his office, the cheering on the floor of the Stock Exchange could be heard out in Broad Street.
Today we had an unintended consequence as a result of Congress, and somewhat like the earthquake in San Francisco that sort of shook the market this afternoon, as far as Turkey is concerned. And I'm thinking now about the fact that we now have things like 9/11, we have instant communication, we have where the telephone was just beginning then, we now have high speed. Everybody knows the news as soon as it happens. Now, what's this going to mean when we get to a situation today that's like occurred in 1907? What's going to be the salvation, if any? Is it going to be the Federal Reserve? Is it going to be another group of great brokers, great bankers like J.P. Morgan? How's this going to be solved, and will it occur?
That's an excellent question, and our analysis of this particular crisis and the crises that follow certainly suggest that it's an urgent issue. Ironically, since 1913, we've had financial crises of national and global scope almost every decade. It is not something that's going to be prevented by the Federal Reserve or federal deposit insurance or the Securities and Exchange Commission. As important as they are, and we need them, they will not cure it. They may dampen the amplitude of these cycles and crises. And thus, the book, this crisis in particular, but any crisis, today's crisis, would remind us that we need to be very, very careful and thoughtful investors, depositors, economic decision makers. The good question about communication is worth answering, of course. The second factor we highlight in our book, namely complexity that leads to the lack of information. It's hard to know what's really going on, and that's what creates some of the crisis atmosphere. You would think that with better communication, in fact, that problem of complexity would be ameliorated. Curiously, though, today we have a global financial system that's immeasurably more complex than existed in 1907. Truly, we have digital communications, but that's a two-edged sword. Whereas digital communications can spread good information well, they can also spread panic and fear just as fast. The word contagion, borrowed from epidemiology, is applicable in considering the behavior in financial markets. Rapid communication was a great factor in the spread of the Asian flu in 1997, the Russian bond default in 1998. It's had a factor in the instability we've seen in Europe and the panic, the run on Northern Rock, the bank in the UK. The best we can hope for is more transparency, not necessarily faster communication.
As Bob pointed out, this issue of information is so important because in complex systems, you have a situation like the Buffett quote where, you know, some set of players in the market don't know what other players are doing or where assets may be or how to value those assets. And so I think as investors and observers, it's incumbent upon us to strive continually for more transparency, availability of information so that we can look into those dark corners of the market where we don't have full transparency now.
My name is Cody Nandre. If I can make a comment to that, it's not information, it's the way you interpret it, because the information is there. And I guess 99% of the US Congress doesn't take into account past history and how things go. So, you know, Ataturk and all that stuff, I'm not going into. And Turkey and Iran have an agreement, military, to follow the Kurds across the borders. The Fed, Kansas Fed, had a study last October 2006. The reserves, New York banks, were at 25%. It's now 8%. Interest rates in October 1907 went to, what, 120, 125% overnight? Where do you see this going?
The issue of reserves is quite important. You've put your finger on a key factor. And it's not merely reserves in banks. Today we have the so-called Basel Accords that dictate country by country the reserves that financial institutions, banks, must hold against risky assets. This is good. We want banks to have cushion. We identify in the book the inflexibility, the brittleness of a financial system arises where there are insufficient reserves with which to absorb shocks. What we see today, however, is the presence of a new generation of financial institutions that are not subject to these reserve requirements, and I refer to hedge funds. We want hedge funds to do what they do. They will spread risk. They will absorb risk. They actually create greater pools of liquidity, we believe. But we know virtually nothing about them. There is very little transparency about the safety and soundness of those institutions, about their capacity to absorb risk. In 1998, we saw the stupendous collapse of long-term capital management that threatened a number of major global financial institutions. Just 9 months ago, we saw the collapse of Amaranth Capital, the hedge fund in Canada, because it had bet wrong on natural gas prices, a $6 billion failure. The fact is, we can ask for all the transparency we want about banks, chartered, nationally chartered financial institutions, but until we know more about the safety and soundness of the other big players, namely hedge funds, there will always be this wild card factor in our global financial system.
Jim Savage, I'm a professor in the politics department. One of the additional lessons, I think, of this experience was that the public deficit, the federal deficit, switched from a surplus of about $86 million in 1907 to $89 million in 1909, which was the largest peacetime deficit the country had experienced. And as a result of this, the Congress asked the president to create a new commission to investigate this, which was chaired by, it was commission created by William Howard Taft. And this commission on economy and efficiency laid the intellectual groundwork for the creation of the 1921 Budget and Accounting Act, which created the Bureau of the Budget, the General Accounting Office, and the first executive budget that had ever taken place in the history of the Republic. So it had a real effect on fiscal policy, which raises my question. Could you talk a little bit about the nature of public institutions, federal institutions in particular, and public finance, perhaps contributing to the problem, and perhaps in line with the seven steps that you talk about?
Yes.
Just one point, I mean, to answer that, and then I'll let you pick it up. You know, one thing, we talked about this lack of flexibility in the system, a lack of slack. In part, that was caused because the institutions at the time, federal institutions, were simply insufficient to provide the liquidity that was needed. For instance, the Treasury really didn't have the authority or even the resources to infuse the financial system with enough cash when it really needed it. In fact, by the end of the crisis in 1907, the U.S. Treasury had been depleted because it had put so much of its gold on the line to provide the liquidity for the system. But there was no central bank, and there were very few other protections at the federal level.
And this grew out of the experience following the Civil War, in which the government had run deficits. It had begun to issue paper money, and all of this was very threatening to the citizenry. The political mood after that swung against fiscal policy as any kind of stimulus in economic matters. Indeed, it really wasn't until Keynes's writing in the 1930s that economists began to popularize the notion of pump priming. The role of government was to stimulate the economy out of troughs and to prevent slipping into them. There was very little sentiment politically in the first decade of the 20th century in favor of government borrowing to forestall crises such as that in 1907 or the recession that followed in 1908.
Hi, I'm Logan Sawyer. In your story, it seems like the industry in the form of J.P. Morgan sort of plays a hero role in government in the form of Teddy Roosevelt sort of plays the role of a goat. It's seems important to me that that is happening in this sort of different regulatory environment that you have alluded to several times, not just with the Federal Federal Reserve, but also a wide variety of other government capabilities. And that seems to me especially important because government seems the ideal actor to take care of the kind of prisoner's dilemma that you talked about, in fashioning a proper response. So I'm curious if you'll do a little counterfactual history for me and talk about how a government with sort of modern regulatory tools may have responded either better or worse than J.P. Morgan did in taking care of this crisis.
Actually, you have highlighted what would be the elephant, if not in the room, at least on the national scene today. This book has stimulated quite a lot of mail to the two of us from, shall we say, certain segments of the political spectrum who just discount and distrust the role of a central bank, for instance, or regulators who would intervene in the financial system. Their point is, look, before the advent of any of these institutions, the United States dealt with and climbed out of a very sharp financial crisis. Why do we need the institutions that we have today? It is not clear what Ben Bernanke would have done differently had he been, at 23 Wall Street on the 20th and 21st of October, 1907. Surely, the evidence is that Morgan behaved in ways quite similar to what Bernanke and the governors of the Fed have displayed in the last 8 weeks. How rapidly to intervene and how robustly to intervene are the two classic questions of a central banker. Bernanke waited, Morgan waited. Why? Well, if you rush in at the first ripple, at the first complaint, it sends signals to the entire financial system that there is a deep safety net and an actor who will intervene to calm everybody down and make things stable. Similarly, if you rush in to guarantee the loans of every mortgagee, however creditworthy or that mortgagee may be, you seem to tell the populace that they can do whatever they like and they'll be bailed out. Surely there is some value to discipline. Morgan allowed the Knickerbocker to fail, one of the largest trust companies in the United States at that date. It was a very painful decision for him. I'm sure he knew personally the officers of the Knick and the investors. Why'd he let it fail? He was making the tough love decision that this institution had been mismanaged and was not salvable. On the other hand, he turned to the very next trust company under threat, long lines outside the doors, the Trust Company of America, and said, this is where we'll stop the trouble then, the famous words. He made that decision based on a very careful examination of the books, and he determined that indeed the collateral value was there, the asset value was there that could sustain the rescue effort, the loans to provide the liquidity for the Trust Company of America to meet its depositors' withdrawals. Bernanke appears to have done the same thing today. He waited in measured tones, first adjusted the discount rate in late August, and then the Fed funds rate adjusted downward in mid-September. this may have been out of self-interest, because the Fed really does not have very many levers to pull in the middle of a crisis. And you don't want to fire off all your ammunition too early in the war. He seems to have responded in rather J.P. Morgan-like style. From what you read in the press today and the observation of where interest rates are headed, surely the financial system is feeling a great deal of pain still, but the sense of immediate crisis is waning. Surely our story would say that this crisis that we're in has many weeks to run yet, until the mortgage foreclosures wash through the system, until the real estate industry absorbs the overhang of unsold properties, plus the new inventory of properties received in foreclosure. It'll be a long time before the real estate market re-equilibrates.
And it would even be, you know, more counterfactual to say, well, if you look back 100 years, what if J.P. Morgan had not been there? Because he really was acting as the de facto central banker. And as Bob just enumerated, he took the steps that a good central bank would do. Yet, remember, he didn't have any authority, any legislative authority at all. He simply had his personal authority and presence and power, and had been exerting that influence by doing a number of things. As I gave you a brief example, you know, jawboning the chief executives of banks and trust companies and asking them, much as Paulson has done recently with the heads of banks, to put together a pool of funds so that they could provide security for failing institutions or other pools of money in this case. He took a public relations approach to the problem, which we didn't really address in our remarks. J.P. Morgan formed a PR committee to provide regular stream of information to the press. But he took it one step further. In the second week of the crisis, put together a separate committee, a small group of his associates, who would reach out to the clergy of Manhattan, priests, rabbis, on a given Saturday and Sunday so that they would encourage their congregations to simply leave their money in the system. So he did a lot of things right, but without having the formal authority to do so. I think we can look back at that as a pretty good example of what we should be asking or looking for our regulators to do today.
You've talked a lot about the importance of the response in these various crises, and in regard to what's going on in terms of the subprime market and the credit squeeze. Can you give or comment on the response in terms of these rescue funds that the banks are putting together and you just commented on?
This is like out of the book. a group of banks that have a great deal invested in the status quo and the welfare of the current system are pooling their resources in ways to provide a super fund, if you will, that will absorb the excess inventory in the market and attempt to stabilize prices, because what everyone fears at the moment is, as these securities are marked to market, that the banks and the hedge funds will attempt to liquidate their holdings in subprime mortgage loans and therefore drive prices irrationally lower by forming this very, very large, diverse, well-capitalized pool of funds that is hoped that they'll forestall that panic selling. In other respects, I'd say we've seen all the characteristic facts. Today, jawboning, the use of the media, speeches, harnessing circles of senior decision makers from the private sector in the offices of the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Board of the Fed. This collective action is taking place before our very eyes. It's the in much more amplified scope. It's the same kind of action that J.P. Morgan took.
And something you should remember about J.P. Morgan is he did not use his personal wealth to provide liquidity to the system. He used his firm, of course, at times, but it was really pooling money and funds from other institutions to provide that net of security. But to put it in some context, it was John Rockefeller Sr. who, at the time that J.P. Morgan had died, said, "To think, he had died and done all that, and he wasn't even a rich man." J.P. Morgan had died with somewhere on the order of $80 million in assets, so he was a wealthy man by any stretch, but nothing close to the wealth of a Rockefeller whose assets at his death were somewhere around $200 million and nothing nearly like Carnegie. So not the richest man in the world, but certainly the right guy at the right time.
Bob's a great case method teacher, and he's always putting the students on the spot. I want to put him on the spot on one of these things. There's one of your factors was leadership. How do you evaluate Greenspan's leadership now that he's getting a lot of blame for having provided too much liquidity in the system?
Well, Jim. It's thank you. That's a great question. It's always great to be a quarterback on Monday morning where we would raise a question is in the era 2001 to 2005, when the Fed lowered its interest rates very sharply in response to a recession that occurred following 9/11. It hit the economy sharply in 2002, but the economy snapped back, and by 2003, it was largely out of the danger zone. He claims that this was necessitated. It's part of the Fed's role to help dampen the cycles of the economy. But by so dampening it, may have deferred the ultimate reckoning and, in fact, fueled the very next period of very buoyant growth, especially in the real estate sector. Ben Bernanke has discounted this. He said, well, it was really needed. There was a crisis on. And they said, but you know, capital was flooding in from around the world. China was building up its reserves from exports. So many other countries were. Where were they investing it? They were investing it in US Treasury securities. That was driving down interest rates. So we had this extended period of low interest rates that, if you had to point the finger at anything, fueled the real estate boom that is now being corrected in the present crisis. What was Greenspan's role? What was Greenspan thinking? What was he doing during that era? Well, he kept his thumb on interest rates during those years. And if you had to change anything, if we could turn the clock back, you might have urged him to take a much harder look, much more sober look at the consequences of keeping the interest rates as low as they were for so long. Bernanke today says, look, we had no choice. We were being flooded with capital. He calls it a liquidity glut. But surely there were other roles the Fed could have played. There's big jawboning role. The Fed and the FDIC could have sent bank examiners into the financial institutions much earlier than they did to grill the lenders on the quality standards they were applying as they made mortgage loans. But it'll depend on historians in the coming years to delve into the archives, look at the diaries, memoranda, and minutes of the various meetings to reconstruct actually what Greenspan was doing and thinking at that day.
It seems like your colleagues want to put you on the spot. Well, I'm gonna ask you, it's 2107, you know, faculty members much younger than you at that point in time, we'll look back and say, well, what caused it, right? My question to you is 2007 just another one of these 8-10 year cycles that we go through, or is this another 1907?
Financial crises are like hurricanes. Each hurricane is unique, and yet we know enough about hurricanes to say that they all begin with moist air over warm water, plus a few other things. And in our case, the perfect storm is very well described. The crisis of 2007 remains very well described by these seven factors. A period of very buoyant growth leading up to the crisis, complexity in the system. We got complexity galore. We've got a global system. We've got hedge funds. We have information asymmetry. We have a lack of transparency. We have inflexibility. Arguably, the financial institutions were pretty well tapped out in lending. They'd really stretched their capital base adequately, some of them would say, but inadequately, according to the you know, the concerns of many of the mortgage originators and mortgage lenders. We have an environment in which there's a great deal of fear in the political economic environment. In our case, it's the war. In our book, we have a paragraph on page 2 that points alarmingly to the presence of war, the presence of newfangled financial institutions, a period of turbulent growth, a moralist in the White House, a period of mania in some sense. And that's the repeatable. That's what they will say in 2107, when scholars much younger than all of us are going to say, yeah, those seem to be the enduring things, the analogs to what it is that generates hurricanes. The story of each crisis will differ in material aspects, but the fundamental drivers, I expect, will remain the same.
And it's just a bit too soon to say where we are standing today in 2007, in October 2007, how this current set of circumstances will be judged. One of the factors is to look at collective action. In 1907, that collective action was organized by J.P. Morgan. Stay tuned to see what happens. But if I may end with just a brief quote and another famous one from Mark Twain. History, he said, history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes.
The regulatory framework that exists today is markedly different, markedly more complex than it was in 1907. And yet there is the continuity is the role of these private credit rating agencies, the Moody's and Standard and Poor's, and in 1907, their predecessors. Could you talk very briefly about the relative role and effectiveness of the private regulators in these two different eras?
So this this mail traffic, this gush of communication we've had from people of you know, various political bents point to the fact that markets will tend to right themselves after a period of time, and that in fact the intervention by regulators may worsen the experience. We'll never know for sure. The point of the central bank and other regulators is to dampen rather than amplify the cycles. We can only speculate how much worse any of the crises of the 20th century, other than after 1907, whether they would have been considerably worse than we witnessed. Milton Friedman's famous critique of the Fed in the 1929 to 1933 period was that, in fact, they did exactly the wrong thing. They tightened the money supply when they should have been loosening it. But assuming a benign and effective and well-informed regulator, we would expect that regulators would produce the desired results. Now, the question is, in the absence of a regulator, can we imagine private markets achieving the same thing? We saw it in 1907. Plainly, the particularly George's reference to the rating agencies is apt. The rating of securities in 1907, I think we could say, was primitive. It was not well, not as well honed, nor well informed a practice as it is today. But that's why we had rating agencies to begin with. And that's why they're paid attention to today. I think the question would be, are the incentives, are the means of paying these rating agencies well structured so that they'll give us fair and fully informed judgments on the securities? And second, will they rate all the securities that we'd care to have rated? what we're seeing today in Congress and in the press are severe criticisms of the rating agencies in the last dozen years. Have they been suitably motivated and suitably well-informed? My guess is that we will see, particularly in Europe, governmental chartering of or licensing of securities rating agencies. We may see proposals here in the United States for the same, although I doubt that it'll get that far. Clearly, you have, ironically, very large, very well-informed, very sophisticated financial institutions managed by very smart and well-paid managers pointing the finger at the rating agencies when, in fact, even in today's world, it is still a market of caveat emptor, which is Latin for buyer beware. The ultimate responsibility and blame, if there is to be blame, should lie at the feet of the investors who decided to buy millions and billions of these securities. What were they thinking? Were they not double-checking the judgments of the rating agencies and the issuers?
The Darden Business School faculty has recently been rated as the best of all the business school faculties in the country, and two of their leading voices here today, Sean Carr and Darden Business School Dean Robert Bruner, are taking this very complex story and reducing it so even we can understand it, have shown why they deserve the rating. Thank you. Thank you.